is looking to enact big changes to the use of force by police. Good Monday morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, a police reform bill is on the governor's desk this month. We'll take a closer look at what it means for law enforcement in the state. What are your questions? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, how the Kids Hope Alliance is reaching out to young people on the First Coast this Mental Health Awareness Month. First, though, here's your quick COVID update for Monday. Over 7 million people across Florida have now been fully vaccinated. At the same time, there are 3,231 new cases reported and 33 deaths. Saturday's statewide positive test rate was also reported at 5.32%. That's up a bit. The bottom line, people are still getting sick and dying from this virus. So please get your vaccinations and please keep masking up when you go into indoor crowded spaces. Okay, here's our top story for Monday, a measure that would force law enforcement agencies across Florida to examine the use of force, including potentially deadly chokeholds, headed to the governor's desk at the end of April. This bill is hailed as a victory for African-American lawmakers in particular who had pleaded for police reforms in the wake of national protests over the treatment of Black people by police. At the same time, some are saying it may not go far enough. So we want to examine exactly what's in the bill and how it will impact law enforcement in the Sunshine State. This morning, we're pleased to welcome two representatives from our local delegation to tell us more. In a few moments, we'll be joined by State Senator Audrey Gibson, Democrat of Jacksonville. But right now, we're pleased to welcome State Representative Cord Byrd, Republican of Neptune Beach and also parts of Nassau County. Representative Byrd, a pleasure to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me, Melissa. Good morning to everybody.
Good morning. And here's our question to callers. What are your questions about the police reform bill that passed both legislative chambers, the House and the Senate in Tallahassee, and is likely to be signed into law by Governor DeSantis? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Cord Byrd, let's begin by explaining what this bill does. Among many other things, it would limit the use of chokeholds by police, which has become a flashpoint for controversy over a number of incidents around the country. It would keep bad cops from being hired. It would change the way officers are trained on use of force. Can you tell us a little bit about this measure and what it would do?
Sure. So you covered some of the highlights. You know, it was very important that we have a component in there to make sure that bad law enforcement officers or those who are fired for abusing their authority are not going to other localities and agencies and trying to get hired. So that was very important. As you mentioned, we are updating the Criminal Justice Standards and Trainings Commission to limit our in training and proportional use of force. Alternatives to use of force, including de-escalation techniques, limiting the use of chokeholds, duty of an officer to render medical assistance, and instruction on substance abuse and mental health illness so that appropriate responses are part of the training.
Mm-hmm. Sure. And it really does address aspects of policing that have come under national scrutiny, in particular after the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis. Of course, that ex-police officer, Derek Chauvin, was captured on video kneeling on Mr. Floyd's neck, and he was found guilty by a jury. How would you assess the impact of these kinds of high-profile videos and also the protests that we've seen, the activism that we've seen around the country in informing the types of changes the legislature is looking to make?
Sure. So I think it absolutely had an impact, and I chair the Criminal Justice and Public Safety Subcommittee in the House, and we had more than two dozen police training and reform bills filed by more than a dozen members. And so this was a conversation that actually started last summer and continued throughout session. And House Bill 7051, which you mentioned passed, it passed unanimously in both chambers, was a conversation we had throughout this session, and there's a lot of different members' input in this final product.
It's 549-2937 as we discuss a bill headed to Governor DeSantis's desk that would change use of force in Florida. We're speaking right now with State Representative Cord Byrd, Republican of the local delegation. We also now have on the line from our North Florida delegation, State Senator Audrey Gibson. She joins us. And Senator Gibson, it's good to have you as well.
Thank you very much.
So we've got a bipartisan panel here with Representative Byrd and you, a Republican and a Democrat. Let me get your take on this. You've praised the bill, but along with some of your colleagues in the legislature, you feel it doesn't go far enough. Why is that?
The police standards, is missing is there's no real teeth in the bill. But let me say this first. This is a great start. And I'm not being negative about the bill in any way. The issue is if there is something that is anti the standards, there is no recourse in terms of, I guess you could call it, punishment. And so that's the part that's missing.
Can you elaborate? Can you explain a little more what you mean by that?
Okay. So, I'm sorry. The bill is about standards, right? And with not using chokeholds, understanding de-escalation, getting training and things like that. And so while there is the training there, there is no there's no sanctions. People would say it doesn't have teeth. So it's like if you break the law, you get arrested, you may spend time in jail. There's nothing in the bill that says if you do opposite of what the standards are, you're going to get arrested, or you're going to get fired. There's nothing in the bill like that.
I see. So, I mean, and police officers do enjoy broad, what's known as qualified immunity, given that they do have a dangerous job and they put their lives on the line. Mm-hmm. That said, you know, let's go back to Representative Byrd. We recently saw Derek Chauvin convicted in Minneapolis because the evidence against him was so overwhelming. It was right there on video. What are your thoughts about what Senator Gibson is saying? This is a complicated issue. Police officers face a lot of danger. At the same time, the public wants more accountability if the evidence shows that a police officer killed someone, used use of force inappropriately. So what about this notion that there should be more accountability for officers who kill?
Sure. No, absolutely. And, you know, on the topic of qualified immunity, one of the components of that is, did the officer follow their training? So I think that the teeth in this bill is because now the state is requiring the training to include these new areas, that if a law enforcement officer violates that or doesn't follow their training, which we are now mandating, then that would be a part of a lawsuit. I think that's where the courts and the legal system will be the teeth behind this bill.
Hmm. Senator Gibson, what do you think?
Obviously, that's not teeth. And it's not it's not really called teeth. I guess we'll stick with punishment. It's not really what the public is looking for. So in the bill, also, as you mentioned, the George Floyd issue is, excuse me, what I call, if you see something, say something. So law enforcement officers are those guys standing by, that the bill addresses that they should not do that. They have a duty to say something to that officer or say something to the higher ranking folks in the body. So there's no dismissed. Filing a lawsuit is great, but there's no dismissal. There's no suspension. There's no nothing like that. So just filing a lawsuit is not teeth when somebody dies.
We're talking, and if you're just tuning in, we're talking police reform in Florida with State Senator Audrey Gibson and State Representative Cord Byrd. We'll go to your calls in a moment. What are your questions about use of force by police? What reforms would you like to see? A bill is on the governor's desk that would change the way law enforcement handle this hot button issue. It's 549-2937 to join the show. Let me ask you as a follow-up, Senator Gibson, this bill would require data to be collected on officers' use of force. It would have to be reported to the Florida Department of Law Enforcement each quarter, theoretically to, I guess, weed out officers that are improperly using force. You don't feel that goes far enough. Is that right?
Thank you. But data is an important component because it helps us to still look at our incidents is still happening at what rate, and is there then more things that we need to do, and who are these incidences happening to, and so that's an important component of the bill. Obviously, it's not necessarily an enforcement piece, but it has that potential to make more changes. So there's nobody's name connected to the data. It's more about incidences and who the incidences are happening to in terms of demographics.
Representative Byrd, let's talk a little bit more about the way officers are trained, especially alternatives to use of force, including de-escalation techniques. These kinds of techniques have become much more common in law enforcement across the nation. That said, you know, there are something like 18,000 law enforcement agencies across America, and they don't all have uniform protocols. Would this bill establish a uniform set of protocols for all the different law enforcement agencies in Florida, or would they still have leeway to do things their own way in terms of how they train officers on use of force?
Great question. So the legislation tries to set a floor. So we're setting a floor that all officers have to be trained to this minimum standard, and we want that uniform across the state so that the officers are getting a basic level of training in these identified areas. But for example, on the chokeholds, if this was one of the amendments that came late in the process, but if an agency wants to ban them completely, they have the ability to do that. But for those who want to continue using them, and there are reasons why law enforcement wants to use them in the specified circumstances, then we say, well, this is how they're going to be done, and this is how you're going to be trained on using them. But it does set a floor on training.
Sets a floor on training. Senator Gibson, do you think police should receive more training on this issue? Let's talk about how law enforcement is trained this way.
I think training is always important, and standards. That, I think, is why we were able to get consistent on this particular piece of legislation. As you may know, many members of our Legislative Black Caucus filed bills different areas that we saw happening with law enforcement. And so the training and standards is where we landed. And I said that, you know, just going through the academy is not necessarily enough training. You've got to get the basics. And continuing education is important across many professions, and particularly if issues rise to multiple deaths or permanent bodily injury, then we need to look at that. Because I know that police officers are in harm's way many times. But there has to be a way, obviously, to make sure that the officer gets to go home with their family at the end of their shift, and the individual lives to go for, being held until time for trial or something like that.
Let us know.
Obviously, there's no perfect world that always happens in, but we can avoid, I believe, some of the incidences and the reduction of death through the training and standards, which is state law, so every agency is required.
Okay. We're talking about a major police reform bill that passed both the Florida House and Senate this recent legislative session. It's headed to the governor's desk. It would limit the use of chokeholds by police, and there would be some other changes into the way law enforcement in Florida apply use of force. What are your questions? 549-2937. Stanley on the north side. Hi, Stanley. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning to everybody. First of all, we are talking about police accountability is what we need in the community. And I'm talking about the whole United States here, not just in Jacksonville. Police accountability, where we have independent accountability when it comes to JSO. And first of all, we are not against JSO. I want to put that out there. But there's officers in JSO that need to be corrected or removed from the police department here. But the police accountability be a good start. It's not the end all, but it's a good start that we must take a very important look at.
Okay.
And we cannot
Stanley. Thank you. Yep. Sorry to cut you off. Let me put that to Cord Byrd. Just if you could speak to that, Representative Byrd, the frustration so many Americans feel, particularly African Americans, when they see these wrenching videos of unarmed citizens being shot, killed, and the police officer does not always, very rarely, in fact, faces accountability for taking someone's life over, very often it could be a very minor thing, like having an air freshener hanging from your windshield and being stopped for that, and then the situation escalates, things like that. What's your response to those who feel that the police officers, and they are a minority of officers, a small minority of officers, but that the police officers that have applied force, killed someone over some minor infraction, don't face enough accountability for that? What about that?
Sure. And I mean, that's why this bill is on the governor's desk. And one thing I wanted to let the caller know that we haven't discussed is that the bill requires an independent review for specified use of force incidents by another law enforcement agency or state attorney. So it will not be the agency investigating its own. Either the state attorney will do it, or, for example, if this happened in Duval County, you could have Clay or Nassau or St. John's County that does the investigation. So we wanted to let the public know that it's not going to be the internal agency policing its own, if you will. So it gives another layer of accountability, which I think is what the public is looking for.
Can you understand the cynicism many might feel that they wouldn't necessarily believe that prosecutors would bring a case against most police officers?
I mean, I understand that, but I don't think that our own state attorney, Melissa Nelson, would have any hesitancy to bring a case if she thought that someone's constitutional or civil rights had been violated.
Senator Gibson, your thoughts?
I do think that our camcorders that the many, if not all, law enforcement officers use can help with that a bit, with the cynicism or the belief that an individual will not be brought to justice themselves for the death or permanent injury of someone that they use excessive force, certainly unnecessarily, and against their standards and training.
Okay. Jim in Orange Park. Hi, Jim. Good morning. Go ahead.
Well, my question was about the training. I mean, you did talk about the chokeholds, but I wanted to know about, are no-knock warrants included in this? And then the other part of training is the what I've heard called police-created danger, like in the case of Tamir Rice, where there was a kid with a gun, the police pulled right up on him, got out of the car, and now they're in danger, so they shot him, or they perceived danger. They actually created that danger. So, you know, the no-knock warrants and the police-created danger, is that part of this bill, or is that for something in the future?
All right. Cord Byrd, what about that?
Yeah. So no-knock warrants are already illegal in Florida, so we didn't need to change that. And this is why the legislative process is so important, because there was actually a bill filed in my committee that would have created a situation in which no-knock warrants would have been permitted. And when I talked to the member, I said, I don't think this is where you want to go, because they're already illegal, and we don't want to create a path in which they would be legal. I think that's important for people to understand.
Let me try to squeeze in one more call. We can't get everybody on, but let's get to Johnson on the West Side. Johnson, go ahead.
Hello. Recently, Boynton Beach, there was a situation where a mother videotaped her son being arrested, and it was later found that she should not have done that, even though she wasn't physically accosting the police officers. Now, I'm interested in how this bill will make it so that there's accountability if it's going to be against the law for us to videotape police officers when they are doing their job, even though it's questionable in how they are conducting their job. And I'll take my answer.
Okay. Johnson, thank you. Senator Gibson, certainly the use of cell phone camera videos has completely changed this whole situation in America. The videos, documented evidence people can see with their own eyes have changed the conversation, and they have led in part to this very measure. So what about her question?
I am not aware that an individual cannot pull out their mobile device and record a situation that's happening. I'm not aware of that. I don't know if Representative Byrd is or not.
Yeah, I'm not either, but I thought I'd ask you. as far as I know, as long as you're standing on a public sidewalk, you're in a public place, you can record what's going on. Representative Byrd, I'll close with you. The governor is likely to sign this. Yes?
Yes, I think he will sign it. Yeah.
Okay. Well, we'll have to continue to follow it. We want to thank you both. State Rep Cord Byrd, State Senator Audrey Gibson, both with us this morning as we talk about changes to use of force in Florida. Thank you both for your time.
Thank you, Melissa.
Later, new leadership at the city's Cummer Museum, and also advice every woman going through a divorce can use, plus how the Kids Hope Alliance is handling Mental Health Awareness Month for kids. It's all ahead. Well, attorney and financial advisor Pat Kilbane is a prominent civic presence in the community, and now he's out with a new book that he co-authored. It's a guide for women going through divorce. I spoke with him about moving forward confidently. Take a listen. Hi, Pat. Good to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Melissa. Great to be here.
All right. Let's talk about your new book, Move Forward Confidently. And this is aimed at women going through divorce, particularly women who have means. What inspired you to write this book?
Yeah. So, Melissa, as you know, I practiced law for nearly 10 years and mainly represented high net worth women going through the divorce process. And I had a number of people since I quit practicing law talk about how the process was very mysterious, and they wished that there was a resource where somebody could sort of pull back the curtain a little bit and give them an idea of what they were going to face going through that process. So after hearing that enough and enough, I recognized that there was a need for that information. So I tried to do that with the book.
Yeah, in reading through the book, you even describe it as when someone goes through a divorce, particularly a woman, it's like traveling in a foreign country where you don't know the language, right?
Exactly. And I even use the analogy of a Sherpa, and I try to be that Sherpa for the person that process. And I don't want to generalize and say it's always a woman, but in a lot of my experiences, the majority of the time, it has been a woman, and the husband has mainly had the relationship with their CPA, their estate planning attorney, their wealth advisor, maybe somebody who helped them with property and casualty insurance. And of course, this woman doesn't have that relationship, nor the trust with those people. So I try to be the person who helps her reassemble her new team and help her build trust with some new professionals that have her best interests in mind.
And so for a lot of women who go through this process, even if they have a high net worth, they don't necessarily, as you say, control the money in the household, right? So this
sure. It
can be a really frightening situation for women.
Exactly, Melissa. It has nothing to do with education or intellect. It has everything to do with experience. I mean, in the division of labor in that house, that may not have necessarily been her responsibility. So all of a sudden, now she's solely in charge of managing a sizable estate. And as you know, there are all sorts of complicating issues. Laws are changing all the time. I mean, we're hearing about capital gains tax rates and corporate tax rates, you know, potentially changing here today. So, she's going to need her own team to help her.
And what is the biggest recommendation that you have for women who are overwhelmed, they don't know about the process? You have a lot of tips in this book, but for someone who's just starting out, what's the most important thing they need to do?
Yeah, the most important thing is probably find somebody that they trust who's been through the process, or maybe, you know, two people removed from the process. And I'd recommend that they go consult with a lawyer first and foremost. Two lawyers, maybe three at the most, pick one that they like, and they're going to have to trust that person and tune everybody out, because everybody's divorce is unique. Different facts, different circumstances, different judge, different procedural rules in that judge's courtroom, and they've got to trust their lawyer's advice. While everybody else means well, they may be doing that person a disservice if they're not solely focused on the advice they're getting from their lawyer.
And in fact, you write, giving some case studies that you've seen in your practice, often women don't think they need a lawyer at all, or they think they can use the same lawyer as their spouse, and you don't recommend that.
I don't. I mean, initially, there's some sticker shock, right? Lawyers are expensive. The divorce process can be expensive, and, you know, sometimes, you know, people try to do it themselves, and they cut corners, or doing a settlement informally without discovery, meaning exchange of bank statements, brokerage account statements, tax returns, corporate tax returns. You know, there are some pretty significant issues or assets that may be missed in that process.
Hmm. And I'm curious, too, to ask you, what's it been like over the last year with the marriage scene and the divorce scene in this pandemic? Has that caused more divorces? What are you seeing?
Yeah, I mean, it's been pretty steady from my perspective. I haven't practiced in nearly 8 years, Melissa, but family court has remained open via Zoom, and even mediations. A lot of the mediators are only mediating by Zoom anymore. So, I in talking with people going through the process, there's less litigation, and the couples going through the divorce process are coming to the lawyers more settlement minded than they have been in the past. That's what I've heard from my friends who are in the trenches.
So is that maybe due to the fact that they're just eager to move on? They don't want to drag the process out. They're ready to start a new chapter, which is what your book is really all about.
Exactly. Eager to move on. Maybe they've been in the same space for over a year, and they're confined together, so maybe it's enabled them to communicate better, or maybe somebody's lost a job or had a reduction in pay, and they don't have the resources to fight that they may have had 14, 15 months ago.
Sure. Now, as you said, you haven't practiced law in a while. You have a unique take on this because you are an attorney, but you're also a financial advisor. And I remember, when I first met you was when we went through Leadership Jacksonville together. That's going back almost a decade. And you sort of changed Amazing. Careers at a certain point. So you have a unique toolkit to bring to the table on this.
Yeah, thank you, Melissa. And that was another contributing factor in writing the book, right? I have the legal experience, but then practicing in the financial planning and wealth management space, I feel like I can help sort of be a translator between the lawyer and the client and help the client understand what a settlement is going to mean for them in the real world in terms of monthly cash flow, right? I mean, it's not my job to tell the client what they're going to get or what the outcome is going to be. That's the lawyer's job. But then for me to tell the client, okay, this is what this means for you in running your life and giving the confidence to them that they can do it and it's going to work out and it's going to be okay. And Melissa, I also serve as an expert witness. So in some of the alimony cases in these big estates, the court will take testimony from an expert witness in terms of how much investment income somebody would receive on a monthly basis that would reduce any potential need for alimony. So not only can I help the lawyers and the clients, but should the case get into a litigation situation, I feel like I can help give the court valuable perspective and assist with an alimony issue if needed.
Now, beyond all of the practical advice, it seems to me that your book is really also just one of reassurance that this is so scary for women, but that in the end, they come through this and often are even happier than before, which you've seen in your own professional life. How much of your role and do you think this book's role is just to provide some reassurance to people in a frightening situation?
No, you hit the nail on the head. I mean, that's a majority of the book's purpose. And I'm glad that's what you took out of it. That's one of the main points, right? I mean, I have the perspective now of, 10 years as a lawyer and, several more post, having a full-time career practicing law, assisting men and women go through this process and helping them understand what the process is, what it entails, and what life is going to look like once they come out the other side.
Well, check it out. This book is available now. It's Move Forward Confidently. Pat Kilbane, right here in Jacksonville. And you have a co-author, too, by the way.
Caitlin Frederick. Mm-hmm. We work together. She's a CPA and a CFA. And Caitlin came to us with business valuation experience. There's a lot of cases where one of the major assets in a divorce is a closely held business. And if the parties can't agree on the disposition of that business, then you're going to need an expert witness to put a value on the business, just like you would an appraiser for a house. And so Caitlin really adds a different perspective in those cases. And, she and I work together as a team, and having that female perspective guiding women through the process was helpful. That's why we teamed up to write the book together.
A great team. Pick it up. It's on Amazon. It's Move Forward Confidently by local authors, including Pat Kilbane. It's so good to talk to you again. Thanks so much for doing this.
Melissa, thanks for having me. Have a great day.
Well, mental health issues have been escalating for everyone during this time of pandemic, but for kids especially. May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and the Kids Hope Alliance is working to help Duval County's children and families get the care they need. Mike Weinstein is CEO of the Kids Hope Alliance. He's on the line. Hey, Mike, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Melissa. It's been a while.
Yeah. Great to have you back on the show. So this is an epidemic right now in this country. Kids are really suffering. And, you know, we see this in our own home with our kids and their friends. We hear the stories of what's going on at their school. It's just been horrible to watch kids being sent to psychiatric hospitals, kids attempting to self-harm. The pandemic has just been horrific for their mental health. Can you tell us a little bit more about what you're seeing in the community and how the Kids Hope Alliance is working to reach out to youth?
Well, thank you. Thanks for the opportunity to speak on this very, very important issue, an issue that has been kept pretty quiet for a long time, but now is getting its due as far as getting exposed and getting some resources put to it. But one of the things that we have found, you know, we spend about $50 million a year through the Kids Hope Alliance, and we tend to have programs siloed in after-school programs, summer programs, juvenile delinquency programs. But we have found that you've got to look at the child in a holistic perspective because the issues that we're seeing are really tied to mental health, behavioral underlying issues. And you got to do a holistic approach in dealing with children. And that has brought us to the point where we are doing a lot more than we were in the immediate past towards mental health awareness. We spend about $5 million basically in a variety of programs geared towards trying to determine exposure that children have that leads to behavioral and mental health problems. One of the biggest programs we have, we share a program with United Way in the school system, where of the about 167 schools in Duval County, we have about 90 that have a full-time therapist, mental therapist, now paid for by this consortium of the three of us, KHA, the school system, and United Way. We spend about $8.5 million putting a therapist in each of the schools, the 90 schools, and then the ones that are left, the schools that are left, share a therapist amongst one or two of them. So a therapist would do a couple of days at each school. The goal ultimately is to spend about $12-13 million a year and have a therapist at each of the schools to deal with it immediately. Different than counselors. Counselors deal with curriculum and things that are related to the school. The mental health therapist deals with the child and the family and the other things that are influencing what happens to this child. And that's one of a variety of programs that exist today that didn't exist about 4 years ago.
Well, that's great news. Let me ask you, too, about trauma training. Training therapists and others who work with kids in what's known as trauma-informed care. Can you talk about why that is so important?
Sure, that's the second topic that I was going to. I'm glad you brought it up. We also are providing substantial resources trying to train basically everybody, the teachers, the counselors, the summer school and after school staff as they relate to trauma training. We've done, I think, about 800 this past year, training about 800 people, trying to make the city, as you said, sort of a trauma-related, trauma-friendly city. And it's an experiment that's been going on now for a little while, and hopefully we'll have thousands and thousands of people that can very easily determine if there's an underlying problem and refer those family members, that child. You know, we moved a lot towards child abuse where pediatricians and school teachers and everybody else are sort of obligated now legally to inform if they see any kind of neglect or harm being done to a child. We need to do that same thing with mental illness and behavioral problems.
Yeah.
And it's quite an extensive act. Another one that's being done in a couple of areas that we're looking at is called Handle with Care, where if a child is exposed to having a traumatic thing happen in their lives. It could be the divorce. It could be seeing a victim, a family member hurt, being a family member victimized. If something happens to a child that would cause trauma, then there's a communication link to their teachers, their counselors, their coaches, everybody that touches the child, not to tell those people exactly what the incident is, but to just say, handle with care this child. So if they don't come in with their homework on time or they behave a little bit differently, there's a reason for it. And one of the things we're trying to do is develop a communication link so that people that are dealing with children would have a heads up if a child is, in fact, facing trauma where their brother or sister or parent, something happened to them and they're traumatized by it. So that's a couple of them that are the most impactful programs.
Sure.
But there are many others.
But yeah, you do a lot at the Kids Hope Alliance. And let's talk quickly about some of the stats we got from a youth risk behavior survey that was conducted by the local health department in Duval County Public Schools. These are really scary numbers. 31% of middle schoolers say they've seriously considered suicide. 16% have actually tried it. 40% of high schoolers have felt sad or hopeless almost every day for weeks in a row. Almost 20% of local high schoolers have attempted suicide. Kids who are stressed financially at home from the pandemic, they are even more at risk. And there's a stigma around mental health that has often prevented kids from reaching out to get help. And so what would you say to families out there listening to this that might have a young person at home who's really suffering? There's help available. Can you explain how they can access it?
Well, there's COVID has made everything worse. Everything that could possibly happen is now worse than it was because of COVID. And the reaction that children are having, being sort of locked down, not socializing with their friends, not being able to do a lot of things that they like to do, and just the learning experience that's been cut off from them has hurt them in a variety of ways. And the idea of suicide is more prevalent than it used to be for a number of reasons. And I think part of it is that children are being raised now where they're not really exposed to a lot of the challenges that many of the older generations have been, the winning and losing. There was an effort to make everybody, get awards and everybody, no one wins, everybody's the same and what have you. And if you grow up without understanding and dealing with controversy, winning and losing, when it really hits you, when real life hits you, and there is trauma in your life, it's much more difficult to deal with it if you haven't had experiences dealing
That's
with
right.
things in
yeah.
the past.
And not to cut you off, but we're coming up against a break, and I want to thank you, Mike Weinstein, CEO of the Kids Hope Alliance. May is Mental Health Awareness Month. Get your child the help they need and begin at their school. Thank you so much, Mike, for your time.
Looking forward to seeing you again, Melissa. You take
yeah,
care.
You too. In a moment, a conversation with the new leader at the Kummer Museum. We'll be right back.
CNS Healthcare is offering an agitation associated with Alzheimer's dementia research study. Has Alzheimer's changed your loved one? Have they shown verbal or physical symptoms of agitation? Learn more at cnshealthcare.com. Announcing Vickers Landing at Oak Bridge, bridging retirees with an all-new Ponte Vedra Beach community, featuring new homes, a resort lifestyle, and a life plan for every stage of aging. Information at vickerslanding.com.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. Army Staff Sergeant Travis Mills lost both of his arms and legs when a roadside bomb exploded in Afghanistan. He doesn't regret his sacrifice, but says it's time for the war to end.
There's no eye for eye. No one has to avenge my injuries anymore. And it's not a conventional war like they're, World War II. Just come back home.
We'll speak with him next time on Here and Now.
Today at 2 on WJCT News 89.9.
On the next Fresh Air, Barry Jenkins, director of the Oscar award-winning film Moonlight and the film adaptation of James Baldwin's If Beale Street Could Talk. His new series, The Underground Railroad, adapted from Colson Whitehead's Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, is about escaping enslavement in a reimagined America. Join us.
Today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
Amelia and her husband just bought their first house in Huntsville, Alabama, and they called us with this warning for anyone looking to buy.
We had to offer $65,000 over the asking price in order to get it. This was our 16th offer. It's been really insane.
We'll share more of your stories and ask, what has the pandemic done to the housing market? Next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. The Kummer Museum of Art and Gardens has a new leader and much planned this year. I checked in with their new director, Andrea Barnwell Brownlee. Hi, Andrea. Good to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
Great to be here. Thank you.
And it's great to have you in Jacksonville, the new director and CEO of the Kummer Museum of Art and Gardens. What great credentials you have, formerly director of the Spelman College Museum of Fine Art in Atlanta. And as we talk about the Kummer Museum and coming out of this pandemic, you have a lot going on. What's on tap for the spring and summer?
The spring and summer at the Kummer Museum of Art and Gardens promises to be just exceptional. We have recently opened an exhibition entitled Sonelli Moholy, Sonyama, Gonyama, Hail the Dark Lioness, and that actually continues through June the 20th. So that exhibition, again, has had incredible attendance, a lot of favorable response, incredible comments from our visitors as well as our members. So very excited about that. Certainly the work by Malcolm Jackson, who's a Jacksonville-based photographer, is on view through the summer as well. So very excited about that. And so, you know, I can never resist an opportunity talk about summer at the Kummer. Although it's my first summer at the Kummer, I'm so excited that this will be back in full swing this year. So lots of details to be shared and announced soon. And then, of course, we're looking ahead to our 60th anniversary. You know, the museum has been a beacon for this community for decades at this point, and we are looking forward to, you know, continuing that tradition and looking ahead and inviting the community to join us and shaping what that future looks like. So there's a number of things that are on the horizon for spring and summer.
Wow, 60 years of the Kummer Museum. I didn't realize you were coming up on that anniversary. Tell me a little bit about the gardens. The last time I was over at the Kummer Museum, it was great to wander through the beautiful gardens. Of course, they have suffered a lot of storm and flooding damage, and you're working on repairing that. How is that going?
Things are going very well. I will say that there are so many forces that impact the way we approach the gardens. Everything from rain, the amount of rain that we do or don't get, to when we decide to plant flowers. I mean, there are so many things that go into the decision-making factors that go into the decision-making process for the gardens. So it's something that we're very, very proud of. It's something that we are excited to continue to invest in and actually invest more in as we approach our 60th anniversary. Mm-hmm. It's very, very clear that the gardens were a respite during the pandemic, and they were actually the first part of our campus that reopened. So we know that continuing to invest in them as a destination for Jacksonville and beyond is something that is certainly on our horizon. So I get excited and tongue-tied and choked up when I just think about it, because they are truly the beacon.
Sure. Now, let me ask you as well. You join a small group of African-American directors leading mainstream American art museums, a small select group. The Kummer Museum did conduct a national search to identify its next director. And they have said that the board of directors, the trustees, said that your strategic vision for the museum aligned with theirs, and they're expecting a period of dynamic growth. Tell me a little bit about your career through that lens.
you know, it is true. There is definitely a very, very small group of African-American museum professionals that direct mainstream museums. And it is my hope and my real deliberate effort and aim to make sure that continues to grow and to expand. I certainly know that Jacksonville has been on the rise for quite some time. And when I think about my strategic vision and my focus, it's unapologetically on access. And I don't necessarily think that that's particularly unique, especially this particular point in our country's evolution. But what I do believe is that I have an incredible team, incredible team that shares this sort of unapologetic, relentless focus on access. The board is certainly behind it. It was something that we talked about during my interview process. And getting comfortable with being uncomfortable is something that I've talked about a lot, because it's really going to rely on us getting out of our own way in order to continue to make museums accessible and making certain that they do indeed serve all the communities, mm-hmm. all the stakeholders that could find it of interest if they knew that they were welcome or knew that they were invited. So there's loads of work to do, but it's something that I certainly spent a lot of time thinking about and putting into play and into action and implementing while at Spelman. And it's something that I'm very, very excited about bringing to Jacksonville as well.
Well, it's great to talk to you. Welcome to Jacksonville. And, of course, let's keep in mind that the Cummer is open free several times a week and month. They have community partners that make that happen, a multitude of them. So check it out at cummermuseum.org. Their new leader, Andrea Barnwell Brownlee. Thanks so much, Andrea.
Thank you. I appreciate it, Melissa. We'll talk soon.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening. And thanks to producer Heather Schatz and director Josh Torres. Catch our podcast up later today wherever you like to listen. I'm Melissa Ross, and we'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.